I'd like to try to study a theme which is the connection, the transition from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, trying to make a bit clearer what is the consciousness of this time of year, and try to clear up some areas that are often not correctly understood. Let's try and lay down a few questions, see if we can use them to build a picture of a fascinating theme that underlies what's happening now, that is often poorly understood. Difference between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and the different focus that there should be. You know, there are many issues that are classical questions or problems that are raised here. One is, for example, perhaps the oldest and best known, is why Rosh Hashanah comes before Yom Kippur. You know, Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment. Surely it makes sense to have a cleansing and an atonement before you get judged. What's the sense in exposing yourself to judgment or being forced to, being subjected to a penetrating judgment that determines what the next year will be, and then after you've been judged and the dispensation's been issued, then to try to cleanse? You see, you have to understand that Rosh Hashanah is a time. One of the major confusions is that people seem to think that Rosh Hashanah is a time of judgment for the next world. And there are many sources that seem to indicate that the judgment that's taking place in Rosh Hashanah is a person's status in the next world. But the difficulty with that, of course, is that there's no point in judging a person in terms of their status in the next world if they're still in this world. Put it this way. The time to judge a person as to what their status is going to be in the next world is when they enter that world. When you die, then is the time to judge you in terms of what you need or what you are in that world. And in fact, we have a tradition like that. The time of judgment is at the point of death, and there's a further phase of judgment at the time of the resurrection, Tchias HaMaisim. But there's no point in judging me now if I'm meant to live another year. What's the relevance of what I look like in the next world? And in fact, the correct understanding is that we're not being judged for the next world. In Rosh Hashanah, the judgment is what a person looks like, as it were, in the next world. That means if a person were to die now, what would they be? That means what's the sum total? What point have they arrived at in their life at this point? And in terms of that, what do they need in this world for the next year? Rosh Hashanah is not a judgment for the next world. Rosh Hashanah is a judgment that means that in terms of what you look like from the spiritual perspective, what do you need next year? You might look very good spiritually and need a difficult year. Yeah, because you might need those steps as steps of elevation. You might look very bad spiritually and need a very good year, because you might be paid out for the trivial mitzvahs that you've done, the small proportion of good you've generated. It could be that a person's being paid out in the very small currency of this world. But whatever it is, the way a person is spiritually, what they amount to at that point in time, in terms of that, what do you need next year? So the judgment of Rosh Hashanah is, what will you look like? What will happen to you next year? If that's true, what's the point? And it cannot be changed. It absolutely cannot be changed. Once the budget for that department's issued, once this employee has been, you know, this contract's been signed that he's hired for the next year, that does not change during the year. That's the meaning of Rosh Hashanah. If it changes from moment to moment, it wouldn't need a Rosh Hashanah. I'm not going to go now into why there needs to be a yearly judgment. Why is it not set up on a second-to-second basis? Interesting question. But the fact is that there's a budget that's appointed. There's a dispensation that's given. That's 1 year at a time. How much you'll earn during the year, what your health situation will be, all sorts of things are decided, live or die. Decide Rosh Hashanah. So now the question becomes, if on Rosh Hashanah is decided what will be, incidentally, you can make changes during the year. But you can never make changes to the budget that's appointed. You can only make changes to the details of how the money's spent. Now, this has to be clear. Let me give you a simple example. You know, the world has four, there are four Rosh Hashanahs, right? There's one Rosh Hashanah for the crops, there's one for the fruit, there's one for the rain, and one for human beings. Take Sukkot, for example, which is the Rosh Hashanah for rain. On Sukkot is decided how much rain will fall in the next year, and it cannot be changed. That's the meaning. It's a judgment. What can change, though, during the year is depending on the merit of those who need to receive the rain, it could either fall in useless places or in usable places. That could happen. In other words, the budget for this department has been carved out. How that budget exactly will be spent, what type of unexpected expenses they'll have, that could change during the year. Is this clear? But there's a dispensation that's, you know, life or death, employment or otherwise. This marriage is continuing or this marriage is foundering. The contract's being renewed for the next year. That cannot be changed. How the details work themselves out through the year, there could be significant changes. If that's true, why do you have this judgment first and then get a chance to cleanse yourself? Even if you cleanse yourself, you're not going to change the dispensation. You have the problem. Anybody? Surely the logic would have been, give me Yom Kippur first, let me come clean, and then judge me. Peculiar thing, needs to be understood. Second question, of course, is why we don't do tshuva on Rosh Hashanah. The mitzvah of tshuva, of repentance and self-correction. In the moment of judgment, surely that's when you do speak for yourself. Surely if the focus is, the spotlight, the focus is now on you, and how you look, and the next year has been decided, surely Rosh Hashanah should be a day of intense introspection and correction. Not a word of that. In fact, it's forbidden to do tshuva on Rosh Hashanah, basically. One should not say vidui, not say a confession, shouldn't mention yourself. The only thing we speak about in Rosh Hashanah is the source. That's all. He should rule over the whole world. We speak only about the crown of the king, as it were. That means a symbol of rule, of kingship, that should manifest and come down. Why? Why only 10 days later, after the whole 10 layers of spiritual development, we get to the time of tshuva? Are there many ways we could put these questions? Let's try and add another angle. The Gemara says that when a child's born, and incidentally we're not here talking about Jews, we're talking about human beings, okay? Because Rosh Hashanah is a time of judgment for humans. After all, this is the anniversary of the creation of man as man and woman, not as Jews. Pesach is for Jews. Pesach is the other Rosh Hashanah, what the Torah calls the first month of the year. That's where the Jewish people begin, going out of Egypt and being formed as a nation, receiving the Torah. That's Jewish. Rosh Hashanah is not Jewish, it's human. Right? Adam was created this day. The language in all the sources is that all humans, all those who come into the world, are judged on this day. So when a child is born and he comes into the world, the language of the Talmud is that he's forced to take an oath. The language there is mashbin oisoi. In other words, there's an oath imposed on every child as he's being born. And the language of the oath is tahit tzadik va'al tirasha, be righteous and do not be evil. Now, that's a problem. That's a problem. And the problem is as follows. The word tzaddik in Hebrew means living up to your obligations. The English word righteous is much too vague. In English, righteous means, I don't know, super frum or religious or... But tzaddik doesn't mean that. Tzaddik in Hebrew means exact measure for measure obligation. Being a tzaddik does not mean that you are super religious. Being a tzaddik means you do your obligations, that's all. There is a concept of doing more than your obligations. That's called being a chassid. Chassid means chesed. The word chesed in Hebrew means free love. Giving for no expectation of return, giving selflessly, giving completely, that's called chesed. To be mischesed im Hashem means that you do something for him more than he asks. You know that your parent would like a drink, even though you haven't been asked, you do it anyway. That's called a chesed. Tzaddik doesn't mean that. Tzaddik means you simply live up to your obligations. The problem is, what is the meaning of imposing an oath on a child when he's born to live up to his obligations? You're already obliged to live up to your obligations. Put it this way, let's focus for the moment on Jews. A Jew is obliged in all the mitzvahs of the Torah. Non-Jews are also obliged in the mitzvahs of the Torah that apply to them. But let's take a Jew. You're obliged in all the mitzvahs of the Torah, and that is considered a binding oath. In fact, halachically, every Jew is considered to have made an oath at Sinai, and for that, and it's technically meaningful. For example, if you make an oath that you will break a mitzvah, yes, you are making a problematic oath, apart from the activity itself, because you are already what's called mushpavoy. That means you already... another example would be, if you make an oath to fulfill a mitzvah, it's a problematic oath. You know that? If you make an oath that you will fulfill a mitzvah, it's a problematic oath. The reason is, you made an oath already. It's an unnecessary oath. At Sinai, inasmuch as you, your cosmic, the root of your soul, stood at Sinai, we all are obliged or sworn to the mitzvahs. It's true in a corporate sense. That means we are bound because in a corporate sense we made that oath. But the point is, as a Jew, you are bound by the mitzvahs of the Torah and you are bound by all its prohibitions. So if you're born into the world bound by all the mitzvahs, okay, to the extent that you actually sworn to them, what sense does it make to take this child who's being born and make him make an oath that he's going to live up to his obligations? He's already sworn to live up to his obligations. Do you hear the problem? There's nothing, you see, you have to think accurately. When the Talmud says the child is forced or obliged to make an oath, it's not a sort of a vague notion of, it's a specific thing. That means there's some sort of undertaking that he comes into the world with a specific new obligation. To put the question plainly, what obligation is there in being a Jew other than all your obligations? If you live in a country and the country has laws, your obligation is to live up to the laws of the country. What other obligation could you take on? If you're sworn, yeah, you know, when you become a citizen of certain countries, you have to make an oath. Oath of allegiance to the values and laws of the country. So you make that oath. Now, at a further point in time, they make you take an oath to do what? You're ready. That's a problem. What's the meaning of that oath? That's a fundamental thing. If this is the thing that happens to you when you're born, if this is your task in life, it's not a peripheral thing. As you're born, there's one message that's given to you that subsumes all the purpose of your life. And that is this oath to be righteous and not to be evil. Well, what is it if it's not the comprehensive mitzvahs of the Torah that define all of life? What is it? Okay, let's look at a third question. See here, the Rambam says like this. How the judgment goes on Rosh Hashanah is like this. All human beings, again, he's not talking about Jews. All human beings have merits and demerits, what he calls schuyos and avoinos. You say, mitzvahs or merits, spiritually positive record, and transgressions, everybody in the world. How does the judgment go? Somebody whose merits are more than his demerits is called a tzaddik. Somebody whose transgressions are more, that means over 50%, than his mitzvahs, called evil. A bad person. Notice that the language is absolute. He's not called a 51% or 52%, he's called righteous. That's a problem in itself. 51% mitzvahs, you're called righteous. Means living up to your obligations. What does that mean? 49%, you're called evil. And if you're exactly on the cusp, on the knife edge, then you're called a benoni. Person, a middle of the road, yeah, person who's exactly 50-50. And similarly, says the Rambam, every country. Every country has the inhabitants of the country generate positive action and they generate negative action. If all the citizens, all the inhabitants of that country, if the preponderance of mitzvahs, of spiritual positivity, if that's where the weight is, then the country is called righteous. And if not, the opposite, then they're called. And the whole world is a composite of all the countries, of all the nations, and it has a status. And then he goes on to say that you should always consider yourself, in fact, he says, not only in Rosh Hashanah, you should carry this over through the year. You should always see yourself as living exactly on the knife edge of 50-50. And the application should be that if I'm 50-50, and the nation in which I am part is also 50-50, and the whole world is 50-50, all I have to do is one mitzvah, and then I tilt the balance in my own life to positivity. The pendulum swings that way. The nation in whom I find myself is tilted into positivity. The whole world falls into positive balance, and I save the world. That's how you should look at it. And then he goes on to say, he imply, that virtually all humans on earth, most humans on earth, are exactly 50-50. Now, there are many questions that arise here. Right? Let's analyze them. First of all, the first question is, why is the status of an individual going according to majority? Incidentally, it's a very absolute judgment. He goes on to say that a person who's got 51% merits is called tzaddik, means righteous, and he's signed and sealed for life immediately. A person who's got 49% mitzvahs, that means he's just tipped the balance into negativity, he's called a rasha, and his language is meis perisho. He dies immediately in his evil. That's the Rambam's language. He doesn't mean dies physically. He means is judged as not alive spiritually. That means the preponderance of this person's activities is negative. He's judged as spiritually dead. And then what happens to him through the rest of the year? After all, we said the judgment of Rosh Hashanah is what you need for the year in terms of who you are. Is you get what a dead person needs. What a person who has no spiritual life, a person who's committed only to physicality and has no vision, no connection, no investment in a higher reality, the person gets what he needs. It means that one way of handling such a person, for example, is that he's dealt with very similar to a statistic. That means his life goes according to statistical norms. If he turns the corner when a bus is coming around too fast, or a virus or something else is getting in his way, tough. And if not, beside it, fine. In other words, a statistical chance happenstance sort of an existence, which is a terrible thing. Many places it's written that the worst judgment you could ever have on Rosh Hashanah is no judgment at all. It's like a father saying to his child, there's nothing more I can do for you. I've tried discipline, I've tried love, I've tried everything, I wash my hands of you. That's the worst thing. A person who's been given discipline, given tough messages, should know that at least he's worth being corrected. The Talmud says if you go through 40 days of your life with no trouble at all, like I'm sure happens to most of you, no? 40 days with not a ripple of trouble, then you are in very big trouble. Because 40 days with no trouble means you're not worth being corrected. There's a long period of time in which you get no messages. That's a disaster. So that would be the anhaga, that would be the conduct of the person. On the other hand, a person who is 51% positive means he's spiritually alive. This person is judged as alive. And what he gets through the next year is the dispensation of a living person. Doesn't mean he'll have a good time. Might mean he'll have tests, ordeals, difficulties, reward, tests, whatever his needs. Obviously, it does not mean life and death, literally, in the physical sense. We do not assume that people who are extremely righteous in the year they died became spiritually negative. And it's pretty obvious, in case you hadn't noticed, that there are a lot of people alive, very much alive, who are very, very evil. We live for a long time. And there are plenty of examples where the Torah testifies that a person is evil and he lives. We're not talking here about physical life. We're talking about spiritual life. And in the context, in terms of that spiritual life, is what the person gets physically. It may mean physical life too. It may mean physical death. But that's what happens. So the question we have to ask is, why is this going according to majorities? First of all, you know, the way the spiritual judgment works is exacting. That's what din means. Din means every hair's breadth is accounted for. And there are endless number of Jewish sources that say that a person has to pay for every flicker of a subtlety of a nuance of an action, even a thought. So if you pay for everything and you're going to get rewarded, in fact, there are plenty of sources that say that the worst individual, the person who is completely committed to negativity, will be rewarded for any faint flicker of a mitzvah that he did. Fully rewarded. The language is Hashem is enem kaper schar kol beria. Hashem, God, does not withhold the reward for any creature. If a person did the faintest suggestion, flicker, element of a mitzvah, they've paid in full. Well, if you paid in full for all your mitzvahs, and you punished in full for all your transgressions, and after all, isn't that what you are? You're the sum total of all your activities. That's who you are. So what's this idea of a majority? Where's there room for majority judgment? Look, I don't know what's going to work for you. Imagine that you are employed by a company. And the deal with the company is that every deal you bring in and profit you make for the company, you get a commission. And every expense that you generate, right, beyond a certain level, whatever the deal is, you have to pay for. The company's not going to look at majorities. All they're going to do is you're going to get, when the counting is made, the counting's going to be made. All the credit that you bring in accrues to you, all the debits, and then they do a big subtraction, an addition, subtraction, and the net result is the net result. Where's there room for a majority assessment over and above a full accounting of the details? How can you be more accurate than simply accounting for the details accurately? Anyone here in accountancy, bookkeeping? How do you keep the books? You put all, I'm not a bookkeeper, yeah, I mean, but I presume you put down the debits on one side, the credits on the other side, and you add them all up correctly, and you put them all together, and you get a figure. And that's your net, isn't it? It's a net balance, a net loss. Do you do it like more or less? Well, what's this? What accountant does all that, and then he says, and in addition to that, it happened to be more than 50%. I mean, what's that relevant?
All of it.
Let's try and think this through as a fundamental question here. Another problem that comes out of this is, what does the Rambam mean that most people are exactly 50-50? Is it conceivable that is anybody who's exactly 50-50? Think through your own life activities. Think through a day of your own activities. Of all the myriad activities that you do that are positive, that are negative, why should he assume that most people on earth are exactly 50.000? Most people? Seems extremely unlikely. What does that mean? Can we add another question? Another question? Even more mysterious. This takes us into a deep zone. But, by the way, the Rambam points out that when this balance is made, of mitzvahs and averis that isn't only numerical, of course. There's some mitzvahs that may be worth many transgressions. There may be one enormous, very serious transgression that might wipe out many mitzvahs, of course. And he points out very clearly that there's quality here, not just quantity, and that the real final judgment is made in the mind of the one who knows how to weigh these things. But nevertheless, this is accounting. Then he says like this. In the middle of this whole discussion, he starts talking about the question, the fascinating question, of a person who regrets his past. He says this. Kol mi shenicham ala mitzvah she'asa. Anybody who regrets his mitzvahs in the past, v'toya la'schuyas, and he has second thoughts, you'd say in English. He regrets the merits that he accumulated. And he says in his heart, these never helped me, and why did I do them, and I wish I'd never done these. I raise the ibed es kul, and he loses them all. What does that mean? What does it mean he loses his mitzvahs? The ein maskirin lo yishum schus, the merit of those mitzvahs is never mentioned again. In other words, they do not count for him. And he brings verses that prove it. And just like a person is judged and weighed up at the time of his death, that is exactly the way at each Rosh Hashanah, so the transgressions and merits of each human being in the world are weighed up. And then he says clearly, a person who's called a tzaddik is sealed for life immediately, and a person who's called a rasha is sealed for death immediately. The question here is, first of all, what is this problem of regretting mitzvahs in the past? Why is it particularly relevant over here? But there's one unique question on this concept that we need to ponder. This is the general area in Torah that's known as Toheh al Rishonis. Toheh al Rishonis means a person who regrets the past. The context is a person who does a certain mitzvah, let's say, and then regrets the mitzvah. Right? So the Rambam says here, you lose the merit of the mitzvah. What would be an example? An example would be, let's say, here's a scenario. A person sitting at home, and they're down to their last sum of money, particular sum of money, let's say. No more money besides that. Someone knocks at the door with a really pressing need. Person's poverty stricken, they're starving, they need the money, whatever it is, a medical problem. Person decides, I'm going to give them the money. Gives the money, tremendous act of emunah, self-sacrifice, tremendous spiritual elevation. And then, an hour later, someone knocks at the door and says, I've got the most amazing investment for you. If you give me that sum of money, you'll be rich the rest of your life. And they say, ooh, I wish I'd never done it, I will never do it again, and I was a fool, and regret to the point that they would not do it again. Not a passing, the natural feeling, okay, we're talking here about the cool, cold, calculated decision that was a mistake and I would never do it again. Says the Rambam, under such circumstances, you lose the merit of the mitzvah. Now the question here is, a famous question. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, one of the great Torah sages of the last generation, once asked his Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim, the following question. So listen, it's a famous question and it's a classic in the literature in this field. He asked his Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim, the great Torah sage of that generation, he said this. We know that the mitzvah of tshuva, which is the mitzvah that we do now at this time of year, the mitzvah of repentance, and the last few weeks we discussed it, that includes vidui, confession of what it is one did, the expression, the feeling and expression of remorse and shame, the declaration that you'll never do it again, those three elements, leaving aside the problem of what happens if other people were involved or you hurt other people. But the raw, the core of the mitzvah, right, the three basic requirements are vidui, which is confession, regret for the past, and acceptance for the future. When you do those three things, then the transgression in the past is annulled. Doesn't that sound very similar to regretting mitzvahs and having the mitzvahs annulled? In other words, it seems like you can do an action in your life, positive or negative, later you can regret it, and then the action in the past is annulled. That's what it sounds like. So the famous question he asked the Chofetz Chaim is, why do we make such a fuss about the mitzvah of tshuva? We understand that tshuva is an amazing and miraculous opportunity to cleanse your past. Is it not simply another example of regretting something in the past? After all, in the spiritual world, we have an idea of conservation of energy. If something works positively, it should work negatively. And it seems that you can regret the past sincerely and eliminate the past. So if you can regret a mitzvah in the past and it's wiped out, it's logical that you can regret a transgression and it's wiped out. Why do we treat tshuva as a miracle? Do you hear the question? Why is the opportunity to annul your past, your transgressions, so uniquely miraculous that we the Midrashim say it was created before the world and it's completely miraculous and it transcends. Is it not just another example? Do you hear the question? Another example of regretting the past. You could regret a mitzvah that's wiped out. Remember? The Chofetz Chaim gave him an answer, which is a classic. And I'll share it with you. It's not, I don't want to spend time on it because it's not the direction I'd like to illustrate this evening. It's another whole discussion. Just for completeness, I'll tell you what he said. Unless you'd like to work it out for homework. No? Not into homework? Tell you what the Chofetz Chaim said. He said this. When you regret a mitzvah, what happens is, in this context that we're discussing now, the mitzvah is lost. Disappears. When you regret a transgression, an avera, correctly, when you do tshuva correctly, the transgression in the past becomes a mitzvah. That's a miracle. Did you hear that? The transgression... Yeah, I'll make you a diagram. How's your imagination? Can I get to you? Here's a blackboard, right? Here's a person who is... Let's take a person first who regrets a mitzvah. Regrets a mitzvah. Person's moving along at a certain level. Particular point in their life, they do a mitzvah. Raises them spiritually. Right? Let's say they give that money to somebody that they really need it for themselves and they give it away. Raise themselves spiritually. Declaration of faith, higher level. Sometime later in their life, they regret it. What happens? They lose it. That's what we said. Lose it, they come down to the level they were before and they keep going at that level. Look what happens when you regret a transgression. When you regret an avera. Here's a person coasting along at a high level, does a transgression, crashes, right? Does something, entered a situation of temptation, lost it, fell, going along at a lower level. Later point in their life, they do tshuva. Tshuva means regretting the transgression to the extent that they would never do it again. If it's done correctly, that means tshuva mi'ava, involving vidui, confession, and a correct understanding of the problem. They don't get back to where they were before, they get back higher. That's miraculous. Meaning that the opportunity of falling, the crash that they experienced, has become an element in their growth. Actually, spiritually, a person who's now on this level relishes the memory of the moment that they fell. Because it's what's exposed the problem, and it caused them now to... Of course, there's one better than this, and that is when you're coasting along at this level before you crash, is to realize that you're vulnerable, and fix it to the point that you go up. And close that weakness without ever having had to crash. But most people don't do that. Most people are only alerted to the fact that there's a real vulnerability when it proves itself by causing the crash. That's the difference, said the Chofetz Chaim. Are we together? That's the... It says arithmetic here, right? Arithmetic. Mathematics. This is the difference between regretting a mitzvah and regretting a avera. When you regret a mitzvah, it disappears. We'll have to understand what that means. When you regret an avera, it doesn't disappear. It becomes a merit. That's miraculous. That's the answer that he gave, and Rabbi Chanan records that answer. I want to share with you another direction here, which is opens up another whole field, and see if we can understand. Let's go back to the questions we began with, and see if we can work through them. I'd like to suggest to you a way of understanding this that's a radical, very subtle, but very powerful, and in fact a radical idea. This is something that should affect each person at a very deep level. Let's go back to our first question. Child's being born, he's obliged in all the mitzvahs, and he's forbidden to do any transgressions, and he makes an oath to be righteous. What does that mean? Listen carefully, listen well. When a person's judged according to majorities, you see, two things happen. Best way I can illustrate this is, let me give you an example. Let's assume you write an exam, a very important examination, and the pass mark is 50%. When you get a result, and they publish your percentage that you achieved on that exam, I would suggest to you that there are two things you look at, not just one. You look at the mark, but you also look at something else. Is the mark more than 50? The reason is, if it is, you pass. There are two separate elements that can be teased out of a mark that's more than 50. Now, stay together with me. Perhaps you can illustrate it best this way. What's the difference between 69% and 71? What's the difference?
2%.
2%. What's the difference between 49 and 51?
Yeah.
Pass or fail? There's also a 2% difference. But there's something much more significant. In fact, many times in the future, you may refer, or people employing you, or who knows who it is, may refer to that exam only as pass or fail. The 51% has a meaning. It means that you knew more than you didn't know. There's certain work you still have to do. It's a specific meaning. If it was money, a balance sheet, it would have a definite meaning. But there's another meaning here, and that is pass or fail. The Rambam means, what he's trying to tell you is, that the preponderance of your activity is not only a score for which you'll have to pay and earn reward, it also is a definition of who you are. And the difference in that definition is if you're either alive or dead. Right? Let's try and understand this deeply. Let's take the example of a person who regrets the past. Let's take that example. You see, you can never regret a mitzvah. You can never undo a mitzvah. You can never lose a mitzvah. The reason is, if it's been there, you have to get paid for it. Let me give you an analogy. If you work for a company and you generate profits, you work on commission, and as the year goes by, you generate profits. At the end of the year, you regret all of it. You regret it. You tell them that you hate the company and you're now being disloyal to it, and you speak badly about them, and you do everything in your power yet to be negative. What happens? You lose your job. Okay, you're unemployable, you're disloyal, but you get paid every penny of what you generated in the last year. After all, you brought in the deserved commission, it was on the contract. Who you are and what you get paid are two completely different things. You can never lose the mitzvahs. You can never lose the benefit. You can't lose the mitzvahs in the world. No matter who you are and how bad you are, you're going to get paid for that mitzvah. What you lose is the merit of the mitzvah that speaks about who you are now. You see, when you bring home deals, and the deals amount to more than 50%, you've generated more than you caused the company expenses. There are two things going for you. One is that you've generated a net balance, and there's a figure. The other thing is you're an asset to this company, and you're employed. The individual who... can you see the contradiction? A person can bring in assets, he can bring in deals, he can make a net profit for the company, and he can change in one moment to being disloyal and unemployable. He's got two conflicting realities at the same time. One is an accounting system. Another thing is who he is now. And they're a complete conflict. That applies, by the way, whether you regret mitzvahs or avarice. You can either be a person, let's say you cost your company more than you brought in. Yeah, you had a bad year. You generate expenses, you never brought home any deals. But at the moment of the renewal of contract, you convince them that you're eminently employable and you're going to do great in the future. Can you see what happens? The opposite disparity. Right now, you owe them money. But who are you? You're a loyal employee and you've got a future. The two do not go hand in hand. They can be completely at variance. Huh? What happens on Rosh Hashanah and what happens on Yom Kippur are exactly these two things. Rosh Hashanah is not an accounting for the details. Rosh Hashanah has got nothing to do with accounting for the details. You are not being judged on your mitzvahs and avaris. All you're being judged for on Rosh Hashanah is, did you make 50% or did you not? The critical question that's being decided on Rosh Hashanah is, are your contract being renewed? Are you still employed by this company? Is this marriage still happening or is this marriage dissolving? That's what's being decided on Rosh Hashanah. The reason we don't do tshuva on Rosh Hashanah is we're not interested in annulling the avaris. You're not being judged on those. That's Yom Kippur. On Rosh Hashanah, you only have one hearing in front of the board of this company. Are you still employed or are you fired? That's all. On Yom Kippur, you come in front of the chief financial officer and they start making an accounting of your debits and credits. That's what happens on Yom Kippur. There's no point doing tshuva in terms of details on Rosh Hashanah. That's not what's being looked at. On Rosh Hashanah is the time to make a very slick presentation about your value to the company. That's what you've got to do on Rosh Hashanah. Later you'll work out the details. But the question is, you're going to be here next year. Can you see the difference? That's why Yom Kippur doesn't need to come before Rosh Hashanah. It's not relevant. On the contrary, the more relevant thing is who you are now. What's your status? What's your definition? Second to that is your details of debits and credits. You see, the fascination here is that both of these things in here are in the very same figures. The very same 51%, it's not two things. You got 51% for the exam. The same thing has two meanings. One meaning is there's a debit credit balance and it has to be settled in detail. That's not discussed here. That's Yom Kippur. But there's also the fact that this represents a pass and you're employed. You have another year of life. It's a completely separate meaning extracted from the same set of information. Is this point clear? Let's deal with the Chofetz Chaim's question, with the Rabbi Chanan's question. Let's see if we can answer that. What would the answer be according to this way of thinking? Can you see? Answer would be like this. When a person does a mitzvah and regrets it, their person moves along, they do a mitzvah, they regret it later, you can never lose the mitzvah. You never lose the mitzvah. It's a reality in the world. But you lose the merit of the mitzvah. You lose the fact that it accounts for 50%. You're not defined as a mitzvah individual now if you regret all the mitzvahs you've ever done. You're unemployed. You've got no life. But you don't lose the details of the mitzvah. But look what happens in tshuva. Here's a person who goes along, crashes, does an avera, and later regrets the avera. So regret for an avera is exactly the same as regret for a mitzvah. It recoups the loss and it brings you back where you were before. But if you do the mitzvah of vidui, which is not regret of the heart, it's confession according to the laws of the Torah. Incidentally, that is specifically Jewish, not non-Jewish. You don't have to be Jewish to regret. You don't have to be Jewish to regret the past and change the definition of who you are. It's logical. What do we read on Yom Kippur? We read the story of Jonah. Jonah went to speak about tshuva to a non-Jewish city, and they did tshuva completely successfully. On the contrary, his prophecy was that the city would be overturned, and they took it seriously, and they made sure the city was overturned. They turned themselves over in tshuva. So they fulfilled the prophecy in a good way. It was a non-Jewish city. According to the Medrash, the king of the city was Pharaoh, Paroi, who had survived. Yeah, when the sea crashed in on him and his people, he survived. He was the king of Nineveh. This was the opportunity to correct himself. When you in simply being human, when you regret what you've done, if you regret it sincerely, you are not that person anymore. You're a disloyal individual. You regret it and move yourself onto a new path. That's logical. You're not that person. But the past remains. When a person's going on a certain track, yeah, they're moving along a certain track. This train is going in a certain direction. The train is heading to a certain destination, and the train has meaning. There's carriages attached, which are the accrual of all the details of your past. Let's say you decide to revamp your life entirely. You make a new decision, you leave that path, you make a whole new decision. You move ahead, you regret the past, you change track, you move to an entirely new destination, but the carriages remain attached. You can't get rid of those. That's your past. It's real. You've caused those things in the world. The world is now resonating with all activities that you generated. They're yours. They're you. Comes along the mitzvah of tshuva, which involves vidui. You have to speak the words. You have to fulfill the mitzvah of the Torah that's called vidui. Your train moves onto a new track and the baggage is detached. The carriage is on. That's miraculous. That you can never do with mitzvahs. The worst you can ever do with a mitzvah is deeply regret the mitzvah. You can speak, you can cry, you can be silent, makes no difference. What you change, that's what the Rambam means. That the merit of the mitzvahs is no longer mentioned. It does not accrue to a definition of who you are. But the payment for the mitzvahs remains. When it comes to averus, when you regret your averus, so then there's a new definition of who you are, but something more happens. If you fulfill the mitzvah of tshuva, not simply the feeling of remorse and decision for the future, then a miracle occurs and the past is completely detached. Or in the highest level, the past is converted into positivity. What's the oath that the child makes when he's born? Can you see the logic of this process? The child's born, he is obliged in two separate things. One is all the mitzvahs of the Torah. The second is when the child's born, they remind him, listen, don't forget you've got another obligation. Make sure that in the details of the mitzvahs you get more than 50 or whatever the pass mark is. Yeah, in this case 50. Be a tzaddik. Be a tzaddik doesn't mean another time reminding him that he is obliged to fulfill the mitzvahs. He's already obliged. Be a tzaddik means there's two elements of consciousness in your fulfilling mitzvahs. One is make sure you do the mitzvahs. Every single one is in the to best you. But there's another consciousness. Be aware. Don't be a fool. When you're writing this exam, there should be two elements of consciousness, and it guides your strategy in writing that exam. One is pick up every mark you can. But sometimes you may sacrifice a particular mark in a particular question to make sure you pass. You see, what's really humiliating is that of these two accounts, there's one that's far more important, and that's the pass. That's the self-definition. And the humiliation of it is most of us never think about that. Most of us get so tied up in the wood for the trees, or whatever you call it. You're tied up in the so obsessed about the details, we never realize who we actually are. This person driving down the road and he's observing the rules of the road perfectly. He's on the wrong road. It's the wrong road. He's got the wrong direction. But all he can think about is the tire pressure and the oil in the engine. He's not crossing the white line. He's got no speeding tickets. He's doing great as far as he's concerned. And he's moving away from his destination. You hire someone to take a load of goods, yeah, and you tell him, yeah, drive up to Scotland and deliver the goods and get it right. You tell him, check the truck and get its tires thing and don't get any speeding fines and make sure to do it right. The fellow goes off with a load of goods. 3 days later, he gets back and you say to him, how was the journey? He says, perfect, the truck is fine, no speeding tickets. You say to him, deliver the goods? Ooh, I forgot. You see, the real humiliation is that in many areas of life, We get the details absolutely. Yeah, we in many areas of life, for example, in a really significant area of your life, like your aerobic fitness, or you know your you know whatever it is, or your business for that matter, the main goals are accurately set, and an assessment of achievement of those goals is measured. In many companies, there's a board meeting once a month, and they have that chart on the wall as a critical appraisal of the goal and whether we're meeting the goal. Right? Because the bottom line, in terms of was success or failure, is what counts. When it comes to a really important area of your life, like your life and who you are, or what becoming of your children or your marriage, most people very seldom make an analysis of whether whether there is a goal in the first place and whether the goal is meaningfully being achieved. Who am I? What is this marriage? What is this family? Yeah? And that's a real humiliation, because if you do it so well at work or in sport, but in terms of what you're actually doing here and what you're actually becoming, most people's consciousness when they wake up in the morning is just today shouldn't be worse than yesterday. You know? Then that's already a successful day. But that's not what you're here for. You're not here to make today not worse than yesterday. You're here today to measure up to a particular goal that is your life destination. That's a great deal more important than the technicalities of the debits and credits. Yeah? Inherent in those debits and credits is something much more important. What does the Rambam mean that most people on earth are 50-50 exactly? Can you see the meaning? Most people have never made a policy decision that there is a goal. Most people on earth have never decided what they're here for. The Mishnah says a person's like a tree. A person's like a tree. You can have a tree planted in a good place and some branches hanging over into bad, overhanging a bad place. Or you can have a tree planted in a bad soil, and some of the branches hang over into the good place. What does this mean? It means that if you're a person planted in a good place, you're a tzaddik, you're righteous, you've got some negative actions, but all it takes is a little pruning, a little bit of suffering in this world, and it's all pruned, and you're clarified in the next world. Or a person who's evil, but he's got some mitzvahs, a little bit of pruning, a little bit of reward, a few years of yachts in the Caribbean, and football pool wins, and whatever it is, and he's paid up, he's paid off, and he's clarified as totally negative in the spiritual dimension. That's one reason, incidentally, why righteous people sometimes suffer and why evil people sometimes prosper. One reason. The concept is, where's the tree planted, and the details. When you are born with your tree exactly in the middle. You're not born good or bad, you're born neutral. And your job, most people on earth never shift their tree. Most people are so involved in the details that they never even think about where the tree actually is. That's what he means, most people are 50-50 people. He does not mean they happen to have 50% mitzvahs or 50% of errors. That's very unlikely. He means most people's central consciousness, the definition of who they are, the way they see themselves in the world, yeah, has never been a policy decision made. Do a survey. Go and do a survey on a few hundred million Chinese citizens. Ask each one if he's in the world. Pick a wait outside the pub here 11 o'clock at night and do a survey on the inhabitants as they emerge. Ask them if they've made ever a policy decision in their life that they're in the world for spiritual positivity, that they're here to reflect something higher. Most people have not thought about that. Ask them if they're in the world for Satanism and evil and negativity. Definitely not. Definitely not. Never. Most of those people, give them a chance to do something good, they'll do it. To help somebody do something kind, they will do it. Give them a chance to cut a corner and do something dodgy, they might do it. Comes this, they'll do it. Comes that. But what are they actually here for? What's their self-definition? Are they here to fulfill a particular purpose that is always in front of their eyes, that's a focus and a goal? Never thought about that. Rosh Hashanah is not the time for the branches this way, the branches that way. Rosh Hashanah is the time simply, where's your tree? That's all. That's why the Rambam says one mitzvah. You see the value of one mitzvah? One mitzvah will tilt the balance. It means the declaration of a mitzvah l'shem shemayim. That means investing in another dimension. You push it in that direction, the 51%, it's not the 1% that counts. It's the fact that it's now, there's a hachroah, there's been a shifting of the balance. That's what it's all about. And therefore, what we learned from this and what we need to focus on is the consciousness of Rosh Hashanah is a consciousness of the sense of majority, pass or fail, renewal of contract, yeah, decision that this marriage is moving ahead, this project is moving ahead, I move ahead in terms of life, in terms of development, who I am. That's what Rosh Hashanah is all about. Not a time for tshuva, that's not the issue. Or rather, it's a time for tshuva in the general sense of regret and remorse for all the negativity. And a decision for positivity, that's what it's about. And now we move towards Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a different work entirely. Yom Kippur is a time for assessment of the details and a full accounting. Now's the chance to annul all the negativity and delete all the debits. Of course, it's informed by the work of Rosh Hashanah. Since the beginning is always setting the goal and the tone for the rest, every day thereafter is informed by that decision. Of course, Yom Kippur has as its root the concept of the rule of a higher reality. That's why we say, Melech, we talk about Hashem being the king of the world on Yom Kippur just as much. Same terminology, the bracha we make, the middle bracha and the amida that we make on Yom Kippur describes Hashem as king just as we do on Rosh Hashanah. And forgotten that I'm here to reflect something higher, that this tree has to be moved. But now we get busy with the details. And therefore Yom Kippur is a day 10 times we do vidui. We go through the whole list of transgressions, every part of my body, every part of my consciousness. There's a radical attempt here to get the details right in such a way that the details are accounted for, there's complete cleanliness, meticulous purity here, in a context in which the balance has already been shifted into the side of positivity. The practicality, obviously, we discussed that before, that is the concept of fulfilling the mitzvah accurately, speaking out of the vidui, we spend the day doing that. Thought is not enough. In terms of what we said this evening, thought's not good enough. Thought's good enough for redefining who you are. But unless you fulfill the unique mitzvah of vidui, the Torah calls it vidui, the unique mitzvah of vidui, actually speaking out the details, and speaking out the regret and remorse and shame, and speaking out the declaration for the future, that is resulting not simply in a new reality, a new direction, a new track. That also results in the miracle of the past being radicalized and being reformed, as it were, resurrected in positivity. Let me wish you all a Gemar Chasima Tova. This is the time for those who have already been written and sealed for positivity, you take a vacation. Those who have already been written, signed, and sealed for the opposite, you might as well take a vacation, too late for anything else. It's for those who are still on the cusp. That's what Rambam says, Yom Kippur is for those who are benonim. Yom Kippur is for those who never moved. That's what Yom Kippur is for. The sense of tshuva on Yom Kippur is to eradicate all the negativity of the past in such a way that there's a cleanliness, and that itself shifts the balance. Okay, we'll stop here.